and spiritually powerful circumstances, as we have all discussed. Prabhuji was engaged in the service of Shaligram Shilas and his beloved Gopal. He had made a bhoga offering. He was washing the plates when suddenly Krishna took him away from us. So, Priti Vilasini Mataji, the good wife of Srinivas Jagannath Prabhu, her very dear friend Ratnavali Mataji, she has written few words about our Srinivas Jagannath Prabhu. So, I would like to read those words written by Ratnavali Mataji, who is Priti Vilasini Mataji's very, very dear friend. Ratnavali Mataji writes, "Ever since I came to know the glorious departure of His Grace Srinivas Jagannath Prabhu, several thoughts have been running through my mind. A lot of what ifs that could have been done to avoid this unfortunate event. However, as practicing devotees, we hear a lot of times that when Lord Krishna decides that the devotee has completed his quota of karmic reactions, He takes that devotee away from this material realm into the abode of eternal bliss. While I understand that it would be very hard to accept the fact that we won't have the physical association of His Grace Srinivas Jagannath Prabhu, I feel we must celebrate His life by remembering Him and His personality that was extremely pleasing to everyone around Him. Initially, when I started associating with Srinivas Jagannath Prabhu and Priti Vilasini Mataji, I felt that Prabhu was quite reserved, unlike Mataji, who was quite approachable. However, as my association with them grew, I realized that Srinivas Jagannath Prabhu had a natural, humble and calm nature, which quite often is misunderstood as that of being a reserved person. If we somehow manage to break that invisible shield Srinivas Jagannath Prabhu has around Him, then we would find ourselves immersed in the world of Srinivas Jagannath Prabhu, also known as Srivatsan Partha Sarathi. It's a world that has the hold that has the whole shebang of a youth that grew in an orthodox Tamil Brahmin family, yet experienced everything that this world has to offer. As such, there are so many memorable before Krishna conscious stories that Prabhu would share with me, which I always felt were extremely amusing due to the fact that a person of His nature that we know today couldn't have possibly done all the antics that He had in His karmic life. Srinivas Jagannath Prabhu's spiritual journey started when He was a bachelor and grew in length so much so that He was probably among the first initiated devotees in the group of His friends who introduced Him to Krishna consciousness. Priti Vilasini Mataji shared how during their early stages of marriage, Prabhu was extremely patient with all her questions and inquisitive nature in regards to Krishna consciousness. Those that know Priti Vilasini Mataji realize that it is not easy task to satisfy all her questions, and was referring to some Krishna conscious experts to her so she could get all her answers. Srinivas Jagannath Prabhu would refer Priti Vilasini Mataji to senior devotees so she could get the answers to all her questions. Mataji continues writing, "I personally feel that the patience, integrity and dedication that His Grace Srinivas Jagannath Prabhu showed while laying the groundwork to nurture Priti Vilasini Mataji has borne the fruit in creating such a wonderful devotee who can recall any verse from the scriptures and render them among the best Krishna kathas. Every time I hear such wonderful lectures from Priti Vilasini Mataji, I realize the amount of back-end support that Srinivas Jagannath Prabhu has provided to her to gain all the knowledge and spread that knowledge to fallen souls such as myself. His Grace Srinivas Jagannath Prabhu holds a very high position in Deloitte. And yet, if you look at him and his way of life, you wouldn't notice a speck of so-called status-like display. There were days in Atlanta where, while shopping for the whole day and having no interest to cook food at home, we would simply call Prabhu and Mataji and let them know that we are going to drop by their place for prasadam. Some of you might know how beautiful prasadam Priti Vilasini Mataji would prepare for Gopal and their other personal deities like Shaligram Shilas. I have observed since past year or so, Srinivas Jagannath Prabhu started involving himself in cooking a lot of prasadam. He would make various cuisines like Italian, Mexican, etc., especially on the occasion of Priti Vilasini Mataji's birthday or wedding anniversary. In addition, both of them have laser-like attention to take care of their personal deities, especially their Gopal. It was known that Srinivas Jagannath Prabhu departed this material realm doing what he could do the best, cleaning the prasadam utensils of their Gopal. Perhaps Gopal has decided that Srinivas Jagannath Prabhu has exhausted his bucket of karma and therefore it is time for him to go back home, back to Godhead. Someday, by the mercy of the Vaishnavas, if I get to meet His Grace Srinivas Jagannath Prabhu, I hope to continue his eternal association. Until then, dear Srinivas Jagannath Prabhu, you will be constantly in our thoughts, in our prayers, and in our hearts. Hare Krishna.
Thank you, Adi Gadadhar Prabhuji. Thank you so much. Radhika Mataji.
Hare Krishna.
Radharani Mataji.
Hare Krishna Chaitanya Charan Prabhuji. Dandavat Pranam Prabhuji. All glories to Srila Prabhupada and our Guru Guru Maharaj. Thank you so much for your association, and I would like to hand over the call to you, Prabhuji.
Om Jnanati Mirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishtaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Iti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharane Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Desha Tarine Vancha Kalpataru Bhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bhyayvacha Titanam Pavnebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, am I audible? Audible, yes, and visible?
Yes, Prabhuji.
Okay. So Shyama Gauri Mataji informed me about the departure of Srinivas Jagannath Prabhu. My condolences to Priti Vilasini Mataji. It is a difficult phase to lose. And I pray that Krishna, from within your heart and from the community of devotees, give you the strength to face this inconceivable difficulty. My best wishes and prayers to all of you for coping with this loss. Srinivaspur was an integral part of your community, and it's unfortunate. But Krishna has his plans, and we have to find out how our plan fits within Krishna's plan. And so, It's a somber note to start this talk, but Bhishma's pastime is probably appropriate on this occasion. So I'll speak. I'm sharing my screen. Please let me know if you're able to see the screen or not. So I'll speak on that. Hare Krishna. You're able to see, isn't it?
Yes, Prabhupada.
So I'll talk about how there's a tension between dharma and bhakti in Bhishma's life and how that tension was resolved. Today is the last day of Bhishma Panchak here. In fact, as the class is going to get over, the Bhishma Panchak Avrata is going to end and Kartik will also end tonight. It may be a day different in America. So I'll speak about Bhishma broadly in three ways. One is, in life, when we do something good, we expect something good to result from that. When we do something which is good and extremely difficult to do, then we at least expect some proportionately good result to come. When we do something good and then we get something bad, that's difficult to process. When we do something which is very good and very difficult, which is good and difficult, and then we get into a trouble because of that, that really makes us start thinking about life's unfairness. So Bhishma's life is like that. That he took a glorious vow. And it was a vow he took not out of pride, but out of service attitude, out of selflessness. And his vow basically had three parts. And we'll see how that very vow got him into trouble. And how all three aspects of his vows got him into trouble. So, you know, we often talk about this perplexing question in life. Why do bad things happen to good people? It is one thing, it is very difficult to answer that question. But it is even more perplexing. And it's like people are doing good things and bad things happen to him. But if the good things themselves become the cause of bad things happening to them, then it becomes very difficult to process. And the Bhagavatam's overall mood is, it doesn't philosophically address the question, why do bad things happen to good people? Rather, it focuses more on practically demonstrating, when bad things happen to good people, what do good people do? What do good people do? So we'll discuss how Bhishma got into trouble because of his vows and how ultimately there was a glorious resolution, how the Lord knew his heart and reciprocated with his heart. So, you know, if you look at Bhishma's vow, we'll see an inversion of generational responsibilities. What do I mean by that? Inversion of generational responsibilities? That normally, parents arrange for their sons or daughters or their children's marriage. But here, Bhishma arranged for Shantanu's marriage. And not only did he arrange, sometimes parents are in anxiety. Okay, well, how will you find a good match for our child and then for our son or daughter? Now, Bhishma, he saw that his father was dejected because Satyavati's father had refused, had said some conditions that were unacceptable for Shantanu. So Bhishma, he was concerned about his father, and he what did he do? He took responsibility for arranging for his father's marriage by taking a vow that I will not get married. So normally, you know, if somebody has a child, then if people, you know, every couple will have their differences. So sometimes when their differences, they may think of separating. But if they have children, then separating is far more difficult. So people may stay married for the welfare of their children. But Bhishma stayed unmarried for the welfare of his father. So it is, in so many ways, atypical. Not only atypical, it is antitypical. Typical is what is normally done. Atypical is what is not normally done. But antitypical is what is the opposite of what is normally done. So, in general, every pastime has a particular thrust. And the thrust is here to demonstrate the principled selflessness of Bhishma Pitama. So now is also Bhishma Pitamaha's vow was remarkable because it was also from a perspective of psychophysical nature, it was also an inversion. Why an inversion? Because celibacy is in general difficult, but it's even more especially difficult for Kshatriyas. Why Kshatriyas is difficult? Because Kshatriyas engage with the material energy a lot. And that's why in Vedic traditions, if you see, polygamy was also accepted. That often men would have many wives. Of course, they would also take responsibility for their wives. And almost every time we see in the Vedic scriptures that having multiple wives gets the person into trouble. But still, the idea that Kshatriya, because they're engaging so much with the material energy, so for them, many multiple partners were allowed. And what celibacy was almost impossible for Kshatriyas. Now, of course, Kshatriyas would sometimes be very austere, but that was for a phase in their life wherein they would want to gain some powers or do some yajnas. So Bhishma was a Kshatriya and still he remained celibate. So from the perspective of psychophysical nature, it is very, very difficult for him to do that. And yet he did that. Then also it was a situational inversion. So I talked about four levels of inversion in what Bhishma is doing. So the fourth level is situational. What do you mean by situational? Normally, every kind of activity requires a particular situation that is conducive. Mm-hmm. So normally if somebody wants to live celibate, so they live in an atmosphere that is conducive to celibacy. Often people would go to the forest in the past, and in the forest they would live with sense control, or those who want to be celibate, they have some kind of ashram in which they live together in celibacy. But here, Bhishma lived not only in a forest, not in an ashram, but in a city, not just in a city, in a palace. Not just in a palace, but in a palace where others were engaging in royalty and luxury and even revelry. So it was all around him, the atmosphere was completely unconducive. So both from his inner psychophysical nature, from his outer socio-cultural situation, what he did was remarkable in its being antitypical. And now if you consider further, to just get a sense of how difficult it was, we have the example of Sugriva. He was also a royal prince, but he was driven out by his brother. And when he was driven out, he lived in austerity. He lived in enforced celibacy because his wife was kept by Vali. But when he came back to the kingdom, what happened? He just lost it. Of course, it was also we could say it was their version of a lockdown because the rains were so high, that so severe that nobody could do anything. And so he had all the royal luxury available with him. And he had no responsibility because practically nothing was happening. Nothing could be done because of the rains. So just lost himself in revelry. So the point is that Sugriva was not like an uncontrolled sensual person. He was a virtuous vanara, but still he lost his sense. So the point I'm conveying here is that situationally what Bhishma did was remarkable. So his vow was extraordinary, and that's why Devavrata, he came to be known as Bhishma. Bhishma means one who takes a very difficult vow. What he's doing is very difficult. So Bhishma, Bhima, Bhima Karma, and Bhishana, all these come from similar Sanskrit concrete roots, which all connote the idea of difficulty. Now, while we talk about Bhishma's vow, it was three vows, or rather, one vow with three parts in it. What were his vows? So first was, of course, he took the vow because his father said that it's a great fortune for my daughter that she is going to become the queen, but I want that her son should become the king. And Shantanu had already enthroned Bhishma as the prince regent. And he couldn't go back on that. So Bhishma went and said that I won't claim the Kuru throne. Let her son become the king. But then her father said that, okay, but what if you have sons and they claim the kingdom? Then was the more famous part of the war, that he said that he would never marry and have children so that his children wouldn't claim the Kuru throne. And then third, he made a further vow that whoever would be on the throne, he would always protect that person. So it was one vow, three parts in it. So he wanted to assure Satyavati's father that he had no hesitation in handing Satyavati to Shantanu. And that's what happened. Then Shantanu, they got married. Now we will see how these three thrones, each of these three vows is difficult. Because to be the rightful heir and to not get what one is entitled to is very difficult to renounce. Then, okay, even if you cannot be the king, at least you can have your own family and have your own kshetra. But he couldn't even have that. And on top of that, it's one thing to sacrifice for our elders. But it's much more difficult. Say, you know, if we are scheduled to give a class and say some senior devotee comes and says, yeah, you please give the class. That is easy enough. But now, if we are scheduled to give a class and somebody replaces us with some very new devotee who is maybe 20 years junior to us, you might feel, what is going on? You may feel bad about that. So now it's just like just giving one class is a small thing. But to have to serve as the king, somebody who is junior to him, that was extremely difficult. So each of these vows, Bhishma knew that they entailed a lot, and yet he took those vows. This was the first part, that his vows were glorious. Then the second part is, we will look at how each of these vows got him into trouble. So we could call it as one vow with three parts. They all got him into trouble. So let's see. Okay, so his first vow was he wouldn't claim the Kuru throne. And that was because he wanted his father to, as I said, it is easy for him to, okay, let my father be on the throne. But somebody who is not only junior in age, but at least if they are greater in competence, then that is fine. But if they are junior in age and they are weaker or less competent, then to serve them becomes even more difficult. Say, if we are told you don't give a class and let somebody else give a class, and we can see that they are making mistakes in answering questions, they are speaking wrong philosophy, and still faithfully sit and hear, it is difficult. And that is just we could say our class for half an hour, 45 minutes, 1 hour we have to hear. But to lifelong serve someone who is less competent than us, that is extremely difficult. And it is not a matter of arrogance for Bhishma. Bhishma was such a glorious warrior that any other warrior would in the Kuru dynasty would have been less competent than him. Or most other warriors, Vichitravirya, you know, he was a hero in his own right, but he was very sensually attached, and then he got a disease because of that, and he died of this because of his dissipated living. And Bhishma had to see this, and then Chitrangada became the king, and then Chitrangada was challenged, and because it was a duel, the Kshatriya codes were such that Bhishma decided that Bhishma couldn't intervene. So Gandharva named Chitrangada. A challenge to Chitravirya, Chitrangada, the Kuru king, and Chitrangada was killed. And then there was no one to inherit the throne. And then Satyavati herself came and said, you inherit the throne, you take the throne now. He said, no, I cannot do this. He said, I have taken a vow. He says, that vow was for my pleasure. That was for my purpose, and I am requesting you now to take back that vow, to do this needful. So in one sense, Satyavati's situation is similar to Kaikeyi's. It was for Kaikeyi, because of Kaikeyi's insistence that that Dashrath had Ram sent to the forest. But later on, when Dashrath passed away and then Bharat chastised Kaikeyi, Kaikeyi came to her senses and she requested Ram. She came with Bharat to the forest and she requested Ram, please come back and take the throne. So and she also said, it is for my sake that Dashrath had taken that vow. So I take it back now. He said, no, we can't do it like that. It's not possible. So just as Ram stood firm, he said, the vow had been given by my father. I had taken this vow for my father's sake. And now I cannot take it back. It is my word I had given him. Only he can release me from it. And he was not there. So similarly, Bhishma said, I cannot do this. So then he got into trouble because there was a crisis in the kingdom, and instead of he being appreciated for his renunciation, people were reproaching him, why is he not taking the kingdom? So, and finally they made an arrangement. Satyavati told that how you know, she had been with Parashar Muni long ago, and they had Vyasadeva as a son. And Vyasadeva could act by the Niyoga ritual. So, you know, like that, the Hare Krishna. Yeah. Okay. So, by the Niyoga ritual, the idea was, see, quite often in today's world, when a man and woman come together, it's primarily for pleasure. And that's why often people do it before marriage, outside marriage, and so many things. Now, of course, pleasure is always an element in that. But in the past, it was also a responsibility for begetting children. So, Niyoga was a ritual where if somehow a dynasty could not be continued, then in the womb of the queen in the dynasty or the main lady in the dynasty, some other respectable relative or person would impregnate. And that would be the only contact they would have. And there would be never any, no kind of relationship beyond that. And that child would be considered to be the child, not of that particular person, but the child of that dynasty. So in a, you could say in a technical sense, Dhritarashtra, Pandu, Vidura, they were all the sons of Vyasadeva from the seminal perspective. But there is no reference like that. Dhritarashtra never calls Vyasadeva as his father. So it was not a, it was not like it was hidden, but it was not something which was emphasized. So, you know, going to that extreme, Yoga was a ritual which was done very rarely. And that was done because Bhishma stuck to his vow. So that was an emergency measure that had to be established. Then we consider, now he had taken a vow to never marry, and there was a mess up with Amba. So it's one thing to not marry oneself, but it's another thing that he had, because he was the elder in the family, and if you consider he was the elder male in the family. So he had to arrange for the marriages of the younger people. So he had to arrange for the marriage of Pandu and Dhritarashtra. And then he got the three daughters of the king, and Amba, Ambika, and Ambalika. And there's a big mess up that Amba said that I have already given my heart to Shalya. So now it's one thing to stay unmarried oneself. It's another thing to, if you have to arrange marriages and celebrate that and participate in that. Now in one sense, it's Amba's tragedy that what happened was she had planned, it was a Swayamvar, and she had planned to select Shalya within that Swayamvar. She didn't want Pandu, but it was not Pandu. It was the generation before that. I always get confused. So she did not want any Kuru king over there. But overall, so when Bhishma won her during the war, during the confrontation in the Swayamvar, and he got her, it was like a Gandharva Vivaha. So he brought her back, and she said, I don't want to marry anyone else except Shalya. So she went back to Shalya, and Shalya said that actually you already been with some other man, I can't marry you. Then she didn't know what to do. She couldn't go back to her father. So she went to Bhishma and says, it was you who abducted me, so you should marry me now. Now Bhishma said, no, I have taken a vow of celibacy. Now there are some people who criticize Bhishma for this. You know, it was he who had got Shalya and Gamba into trouble. So it was his responsibility to get her out of trouble. Now, it is very difficult. I mean, life puts us in perplexities. Right? Now, if Bhishma had accepted Amba's predicament, was he actually extending himself out of compassion for her? Or was he going to see that as a temptation, that situation had put him in temptation, and even amid temptation, he was going to stay firm? So, you know, these are calls of judgment that have to be made. And it is very difficult for us to judge from a distant place. It's like in India, cricket is a favorite game for many people. And many people make comments, oh, this batsman should have batted like this, or this bowler should have bowled like this, or this player should have come at this point in the rank. So it's very easy to become like a commentator who comments on the morality of things. or the rightness. There is not morality on the rightness of things. But in this case, you know, some people might say that it was his responsibility, but he saw that it is a test for him. Is he going to stick to is he going to use this to give in to a temptation, or is he going to stick to his vow? And he chose to stick to his vow. So what happened was, here, which was a dharmak sankat for him, there is a generic kshatriya duty, that's protect women, and it was a specific personal vow, stay unmarried. So which does he prioritize? So he, in that particular situation, chose to prioritize his vow to stay unmarried. And Amba decided to, she was enraged by this, and she felt, you have ruined my life, and therefore I will ruin your life. And how did she go about doing that? She decided, she performed great austerity, and she eventually became Shikhandi, who became the part of the cause of Bhishma's death. So the point was that his vow of being celibate, it did not come easy for him. It got him into a good amount of trouble. So now, was Bhishma culpable? So it's life's perplexity such that even if we can't figure out, we have to move out by accepting and letting go. Now, we want to figure out at times, but sometimes we just can't. Why did this happen? What am I supposed to do in this situation? Well, we make a decision and we move on. Sometimes it's the right decision, sometimes it's the wrong decision. And life doesn't come with a guarantee of right decisions. And sometimes the decision that seems right now can turn out to be wrong in terms of the eventual consequences. So how does one really decide? That's why dharma se tattvam nihitam guhayam. Dharma is very difficult to know. And so Amba was vengeful, and she performed severe austerity to kill Bhishma, and she became Shikhandi. Now, so I talked about the first vow, to not become the king. Second is the vow to not marry. And the third vow was to defend the Kuru ruler. And this was the vow that caused him the greatest pain. You know, it was the first two vows, they got him into trouble for some time when he was facing an ethical dilemma. But this third vow got him into big trouble for a long time. At that, when he took that vow, he could probably not have conceived a situation where a wretch like Duryodhana would occupy power and force fratricidal war against his own cousins. It's very painful for someone to not be able to protect their dependents. If somebody has, parents have a child and the child is falling into some bad habits, and then they want to help, but the child is not listening to them, or the child has some terrible sickness, and whatever they do, they can't help the child free from pain. Then if we are meant to protect someone and we are not able to do anything for them, there are a few things as painful as that. So now for Bhishma, he had a responsibility to the future generations, and especially among the Kuru family. So he felt a special sense of responsibility for the Pandavas, because they didn't have a father. And yet he could do nothing. Not only could he not protect the Pandavas, he eventually was put in a situation where he had to fight against the Pandavas. And so difficult are the duties of Kshatriyas, and even more difficult are the complications that we may get into in life because of our vows. So here, Bhishma tried again and again to persuade Duryodhana that give up your evil determination, but Bhishma to antagonize the Pandavas. But he never listened. And eventually, and he rejected Krishna's peace proposal. And in a private meeting before Krishna came for the peace proposal, Duryodhana said that I am planning to arrest Krishna. And Bhishma was infuriated. He said, what you are thinking is too horrible to contemplate. Leave alone, it's impossible to execute. But what harm has Krishna ever done to you? And he is the all-powerful divine. We will never be able to arrest him. Just the thought of doing like this will condemn you forever. Bhishma couldn't tolerate the thought that in the same assembly where Draupadi had been dishonored, Krishna might be dishonored. Just walk out of the assembly And that time, that was the time when he really thought, why do I have to stick by Bhishma's, this Duryodhana side? I just renounce the world and go away. But he did not do that. He stood by the side of Duryodhana because he was bound by his vow. So it is tragic. Sometimes the word of honor can force people to do dishonorable things. And his having to fight on the side of the Kauravas was unfortunate. But there was a purpose that was served over that. Sorry. So there are levels of tension. So in the first and second dharmas, the second vows, there's tension among different dharmas for him. You know, should he follow the dharma of maintaining his vow that he will not take the kingdom? Or should he follow the vow of maintaining that the succession goes on, that the line goes on? So that was one level of tension. Second, two dharmas. So the dharma of celibacy or the dharma of kula dharma. And second was the dharma of a kshatriya or a dharma of an individual dharma of again being a celibate. So now third tension was somewhat different. It was a tension between at one level dharma and bhakti. Because Krishna was on the opposite side. So would he stick to his dharma by maintaining his vow or would he serve Krishna? Would he choose bhakti? So he actually reconciled those by choosing bhakti in an extraordinarily inconceivable way. So when Draupadi had been disrobed, what happened was he had been confused because there's an ethical confusion over there. He said the wife belongs to the husband or nothing belongs to a slave. So that was the confusion. Did Yudhishthir have the right to even put Draupadi on the stake? So during Draupadi's disrobing, what happened was there was a devotional tension that ultimately everybody remained passive and helpless because of a reason. That was to demonstrate the devotional truth that we ultimately have no protector except Krishna. That Krishna is our only protector. So he had to play that unflattering role. The unflattering role was that although he was a protector, he didn't protect. So similarly, just as Bhishma remained silent during Draupadi's disrobing, he remained silent during, he sided with Kauravas in Kurukshetra to be a part of a leela of Krishna. What was that leela? At the ethical level, he was bound by a vow. Now, some people say that the Mahabharata itself has a verse where he says that he was bound by money. But that's very superficial. I'll come to that. So what happened was, why is it superficial? Because Bhishma was not an employee of the Kurus. He was a member of the royal family. So he was entitled to some amount of royal wealth and royal privilege. So, but he was out of his humility saying that I am bound by wealth. And that's why I have to fight against the Kaurav, against you, Pandu, or Yudhishthir. That's what he said over there. But the internal reason was that the Lord wanted to use him to demonstrate a particular truth. And that truth is, no matter how powerful anyone may be, if that person fights against the Lord, that person will eventually be destroyed. So Bhishma was a glorious Kshatriya. He was not only good in Shastra, he was also good in Shastra. He was glorious in every way. And yet, when he fought against Krishna, and against Pandavas, he would be defeated. So, there was an internal reason for that. The external reason was ethical confusion. The internal reason was a devotional surrender, a devotional dedication. So, there are multiple levels at which things are happening. Then if we go further, the last part is, how did the Lord reciprocate with Bhishma's heart? You know, most of us know this picture of how Bhishma was attacked by Krishna with a wheel. So this is one of the most moving pastimes. And I will talk about this pastime through three levels of reciprocation. The reciprocation between Krishna and Arjuna, the reciprocation between Krishna and Bhishma, and the reciprocation between Bhishma and Arjuna. So, let's start with the Bhishma Arjuna level of reciprocation. So what happened over here is that for Arjuna, Bhishma was like a surrogate father. In fact, in the Kurukshetra war, when Bhishma was attacking very fiercely, Arjuna just didn't have the heart to fight back. And Arjuna told Krishna, when I was a small child, I would play outside and then run back home and climb onto Bhishma's lap and soil his clothes. And then I would play with his beard. And I would say, Father, Father. And Bhishma would ruffle my hair. And he would say, Child, I'm not your father. I'm the father of your father. Mm-hmm. So, he says, he loved me so much. How can I fight against him? How can I attack him? How can I kill him? So, Arjuna had that soft-heartedness, because of which Arjuna didn't want to fight wholeheartedly again. Although Arjuna fought, he didn't fight wholeheartedly. And in fact, the very first day, Bhishma fought so fiercely that Yudhishthira became so disheartened. He said that there's no way we can win with Bhishma fighting like this. Better let us renounce our claim and let us cancel this war and let us go to the forest. Krishna told Yudhishthira, consoling him, don't lose heart. There are ups and downs in war. And Arjuna at that time, Arjuna repeatedly would say, I will fight against Bhishma and I will curb him. But I will crush him. But when the actual moment would come when he would have a fight against Bhishma, he just didn't have the heart. Now Arjuna had fought against Bhishma earlier at Virat and he had defeated him. But that was a different situation. Why different situation? Because that was not a fight to death. In Virat, actually none of the Kuru warriors were killed. Arjuna simply wanted to teach them a lesson. So, but here he knew. In this war, if he fought with Bhishma, one of them would not return from the battlefield alive. So that was an entirely different level of fighting. He just didn't have the heart to fight. So he was half-hearted. He was half-hearted. And Bhishma, of course, he didn't have the heart to fight against Arjuna. Arjuna had been like a dream come true for him. In general, sometimes there is this vision that people who are in power, they exploit everybody else and they keep everybody else down. Well, it can happen, but those people who are really talented, who are really champions in any way, one of the greatest joys of their life is not just how glorious a champion I become, but also how I can help others to rise, how I can help others to grow and fly. So for somebody who is for Bhishma, he was a glorious warrior.
Hare Krishna, Prabhuji.
Hare Krishna.
Sorry to interrupt, yes? But your voice is low. It's going in and out. We could hear, but it's very low.
Oh God.
No, that's okay, Prabhu. We could hear, but no. If you do something, that would be nice.
I'm very sorry. Actually, I usually use a mic.
Now it's good.
Now it will be much better. Is it better now?
Yes, yes, Prabhuji.
Hare Krishna.
Yes.
Okay, good. Thank you for telling me. This is silly. I should have checked this before. So, do I need to summarize again or should I just continue from where I am? What I spoke till now, was it?
Just continue, Prabhuji. We heard everything, but it was low. It's very difficult, very hard to hear. So, that's why.
But now, is it better?
Yes, yes. Sure.
Okay, thank you. So, by the way, how much time do we have more usually until what time your class goes?
You have 25 minutes, 20 minutes.
Okay, 20 minutes more, about 1 hour, okay.
Yeah.
So I was talking about how there was a reciprocation between Bhishma and Arjuna over there. So Bhishma, one of the greatest joys of his life was to see how Arjuna had become such a glorious warrior. And he had no heart to fight against Arjuna. But at the same time, he knew that he had a duty. So Bhishma fought fiercely in the Kurukshetra war because he wanted Arjuna to fight fiercely so that Arjuna's glory would be seen for by everyone. And Bhishma, you know, somebody who's an experienced warrior, they know what their strength is, what their opponent's strength is. So Bhishma eventually said that this is the scene on the ninth evening of the ninth day of the Kurukshetra war. And what happened over here was something special, that Bhishma on that day took a vow that today I will fight, and I'll kill Arjuna, kill the Pandavas, or I will force Krishna to lift a weapon. So why was he doing this? He was doing this because he wanted to reveal. So he was fighting heroically, fiercely initially, to get Arjuna to fight heroically and to reveal Arjuna's glory to the world. But now he started fighting heroically, fiercely, so that Krishna's love would be revealed to the world. So I'll explain how that happens. So I talked about the reciprocation between Krishna, between Bhishma and Arjuna. Now in the same picture, you can look at the reciprocation between Krishna and Arjuna. So Krishna and Arjuna, the reciprocation was that Krishna had, out of love for Arjuna, become his charioteer. And that was wonderful. He had become his charioteer and he was ready to fight, be like an assistant to him. And Krishna had taken a vow that I will not raise any weapons henceforth. Now, there are multiple levels of reasons why Krishna chose not to use weapons. And that could be a separate class in itself. I won't go into that. Our Gaudiya Vaishnava Acharyas give very beautiful esoteric example, explanations for Krishna's refusal to raise weapons. But that apart, Krishna had taken that vow. And Krishna was constantly encouraging, pushing, sometimes chiding Arjuna. You have to fight. This is your duty. You said that you will be able to overcome Bhishma easily. What is happening to your word, which you had taken before the war started? But eventually, when he saw that Bhishma was just, that Arjuna was not fighting wholeheartedly, and Bhishma was fighting fiercely, he realized this is a mismatch. Arjuna will be killed soon. So Krishna took the matter in his own hands. Now he had come as a charioteer, he was unarmed. So he looked around and he saw a wheel. Just jumped off the chariot and ran to the wheel and picked up the wheel. Now, after taking the wheel, he started running toward Bhishma. And as he was running toward Bhishma, Arjuna was shocked. Krishna, please don't dishonor your word. I will fight wholeheartedly. But Krishna was blinded by anxiety and anger. Anxiety for Arjuna's safety and anger at Bhishma for endangering Arjuna. He started charging toward Bhishma. Now, you see, why did Krishna pick up the Sudarshan? Pick up the chakra? Now, he could have summoned his own Sudarshan chakra. But at that time, he was so blinded by anxiety and anger that he didn't think about Sudarshan chakra. He just looked around and found a wheel and picked it up. Now, wheel is not technically a weapon, but he picked it up. It is similar to his Sudarshan chakra. Normally, whenever Krishna releases the Sudarshan chakra, it is not that Krishna runs toward the opponent and then hurls the Sudarshan chakra at them. Wherever he is, Krishna just releases the Sudarshan chakra, and that goes and now lops off the head of that person. So why did Krishna run like this? Now, Krishna was so anxious that he wanted to make sure that he didn't miss the target. So if we shoot a gun from a distance, sometimes we might miss the target. If we are close, we won't miss the target. So he wanted to make sure that he didn't miss. And that's why he charged so close. He came close quarters. And then as Arjuna was calling Krishna, stop. But Krishna just didn't hear. So Arjuna jumped off the chariot and ran after Krishna, calling him, stop, stop. And Bhishma saw that Krishna was charging toward him. Bhishma smiled. He said, mission successful. And Bhishma, he said, put aside his bow. And he said, oh Vasudev, there's nothing more fortunate for me than to die at your hands. And Krishna was so angry. He said, there's nothing for you to smile here. He says, you are the root cause of this war. When a king goes on a wrong path, it is the duty of the minister to stop him. Because you didn't stop Dhritarashtra, that's why this war has occurred. And you will be punished for your passivity. Bhishma just smiled and he said, "Oh Vasudev, your judgment is flawless. I tried my best, but Dhritarashtra never listened to me. He was too attached to Duryodhan." And this was, the exchange was going on while Krishna was furiously charging toward Bhishma. And Arjuna saw that he couldn't, that Krishna was not ready to listen to him. So Arjuna just took a long leap and he caught Krishna around his thigh. And yet Krishna kept running. And then Arjuna lifted up his long, his powerful Kshatriya legs and banged them on the ground. And that created a literally a hole in the ground. And his legs got stuck in that hole and his hands were holding on to the thigh of Krishna. And because Arjuna became immobilized because of his legs being stuck in the ground and he was holding on to Krishna, Krishna became immobilized. And then Arjuna told Krishna, "Krishna, stop, stop, stop. I will fight. I will kill Bhishma. You don't have to give up your word." And by this time, Krishna had calmed down. And then Krishna turned and they walked back. So here, Krishna shows how much he loves his devotees. So we see earlier that Dasharatha Maharaj was not ready to give up his word for the sake of Ram. The word of honor is very important. Now Krishna had also given a word of honor, "I'll not raise weapons," but he gave up that word. So how big a thing that is, we understand if you look at the Kshatriya context of how important the word of honor was for them. But most importantly for our pastime is how Krishna was reciprocating with Bhishma. So Bhishma was in some ways in the Viryaras. So it brought out the heroism in Krishna. There's one kind of Viryaras which Krishna enjoys in the Maushala Leela. When some devotees play the roles of demons like Jai Vijay become Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu or Ravan Kumbhakarna, Shishupal Dantavakra. But here it is different. Here it is something else, where they become nothing but where it's a devotee but playing a non-devotional role or anti-devotional role. And they had a very special reciprocation. Krishna's anger at Bhishma was more an expression of his love for Arjuna than an anger at Bhishma per se. And how he was not really angry with Krishna, he was not really angry with Bhishma was seen by at the end when Krishna came to be with Bhishma. To help him in his last days, in his final journey. And what happened over there was that Bhishma at one level had a very painful death because so many arrows were piercing through his body. And he had to live like that for a long time. He chose to live like that because he wanted to behold the Pandavas' victory. He had Ichha Mrityu and he could have died at any time. He could have ended his life at any time, but he chose to live on because he wanted to see the glory of the Pandavas, and he knew Krishna had some service for him. And Krishna gave Bhishma the greatest honor. Apparently, the person who had acted adharmically by fighting against the Lord of Dharma, that is Krishna, that same person who had apparently fought against the Lord of Dharma came to him to learn about Dharma and to say that, you know, "I cannot tell Dharma as well to Yudhishthir as you can." So this is where there is dynamism, you know. I'll conclude with this one very important point, that from an ethical perspective, Bhishma's remaining silent when Draupadi was being dishonored was wrong. Whatever be the technicalities, the idea that a royal lady could be dishonored like this in public in the royal assembly, that is unconscionable. So his siding with Duryodhana, whatever be the circumstances, that was adharmic. So Krishna, just because Bhishma was a devotee, does not mean that Krishna overlooked Bhishma's adharmic activity. So Bhishma's wrongs were not overlooked because of his devotion. But at the same time, his devotion was not overlooked because of his wrongs. And because of his wrongs, there was a consequence that he had to suffer a painful death. But because of his devotion, what happened was he attained a transcendental consciousness and he didn't suffer because of that. He didn't suffer because his consciousness was transcendental and the Lord reciprocated with him by glorifying him, by taking the position of being a student before Bhishma, by showing that Bhishma is a superior teacher than me, and then ultimately being with Bhishma when he departed from the world. So this is actually there is always a tension within bhakti also, that there is ethical and there is transcendental. So what if some devotee does something ethically wrong? Should that devotee just be forgiven? We say, yes, as devotees, we should forgive each other. Yes, but what if that ethical conduct has serious consequences? So sometimes at a public level, a devotee may need, sometimes at one level, a devotee needs to be disciplined. At another level, a devotee needs to be reassured. So of course, we cannot judge Bhishma like an ordinary devotee. He's a Mahajana. But even through the Mahajana's lives, the Lord teaches us a valuable lesson that dharma is not to be neglected for bhakti and bhakti is not to be overlooked for dharma. Both can go together, and both go together by focusing on the heart's intention more than on the situational actions. Oh, you did this and you did that, and you, how could you have spoken this and how could you have spoken that? No, don't get caught in actions. Look at the intentions and then move forward from there. So when we are having arguments or fights, now our purpose is not to prove that we are right. Our purpose is to find what is right and then do what is right. And what is right, quite often, especially in devotional contexts, is not so much to victory as peace. We don't want to defeat our loved ones. We don't want to defeat devotees. We don't want to win over devotees. Rather, what we want is, we want peace. We want a peaceful reconciliation. In the Kurukshetra war, fighting was inevitable because Duryodhana was involved. It was not just a tension between Krishna and Bhishma, or Arjuna and Bhishma. Sometimes fighting may be required, but there was no personal vendetta. There was no personal animosity. And eventually there was a sweet devotional reconciliation where Bhishma prayed to Krishna and Krishna blessed Bhishma, and Bhishma had such a glorious departure that he's considered the acharya for dying. That how one can depart in a glorious way. We all pray that we can get the blessings of Bhishma and have a departure somewhat like Bhishma's. So that is the significance of Bhishma's position in the bhakti tradition. And toward the end of this Bhishma Panchak, we can pray to Bhishma that he can give us some blessing, some benediction, by which we can also become uplifted and enriched in our devotion and our dharma as we navigate our way through the complexities that we face in our lives. So I'll summarize. I spoke today on the topic of Bhishma and the tensions in Bhishma's lives. So the underlying thread that we discussed was that when we do something good and that very good action gets us into trouble, it's very difficult to digest that. So Bhishma took 3 glorious vows and all of them got him into trouble. So the 3-part vow was that he said that I will not lay claim on the kingdom. I will not marry so that there will be no successors who will lay claim on the kingdom. And I will not myself, I will protect the king, whoever is the king. And all of them had to, all of those vows got him into trouble because there were no worthy king's successors, and eventually Niyoga had to be performed. Then there was a complexity with Amba where he had to choose between his personal vow and his Kshatriya duty. And then eventually Duryodhana was such a wretch who wanted to destroy his own cousins. He had to serve Duryodhana. So ultimately, although he had to go through all these difficulties, the Lord knew his heart and the Lord reciprocated with him. So we discussed about 3-fold reciprocations between Arjuna and Bhishma, Krishna and Arjuna, and Krishna and Bhishma. So Krishna did not overlook Bhishma's wrong actions just because of his devotion, but did not overlook his devotion because of his wrong actions. He reciprocated with both, and ultimately his heart's pure intention were rewarded by the Lord treating him like a superior instructor and the Lord elevating him to the ultimate destination by his personal presence. So thank you very much. Is there any quick question or comment?
Yes, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu. Hare Krishna, Prabhu.
Yes, I can. Yes, I can hear you. Yes, please tell me.
I want you to tell me the Swadharma. Please throw some light on Swadharma.
Okay. So what is Swadharma? How can we know our Swadharma? Well, broadly speaking, we could say in the past, the Swadharma was known because more or less people would be born in the same family in which they had their psychophysical nature. So Kshatriya and Kshatrayani, they would have Kshatriya progeny. So that time determining the Swadharma was relatively easier. In today's world, it is much more complicated. But the essence of the Swadharma is that Guna Karma Vibhagasha, as Krishna says. Guna can refer to what we are good at doing. So basically it can be called as competence and comfort. So that means, you know, if we look at our life and see what all we are doing, there are certain things which we are obligated to do just because of our situation we are in. Say we are in a family relationships, so we have certain duties. So those are at one level our dharma. Then we have our career or we have our job. There we have certain dharmas. Yeah, please come. It's open. Sorry for the disturbance. So then we have the other aspects of it. That is, with respect to our career or our other services or our other interests. So there we can look at, in general, sometimes we are circumstantially forced to, because this is what is the career available for me. This is what helps me to earn a livelihood. So we do what we can. But there are choices for us to make. So if we look among whatever things we are doing, we look at what are the things that we are good at doing and what are things we feel good doing. If we can find a balance of both of those, then we can move forward much more easily. So then how to orient our life in that direction, whether it is immediately possible or it takes time, that will vary. So I would say that there are three factors: self-observation to understand ourselves. You know, okay, I'm doing so many things. Which am I good at doing? Which am I feel good doing? So look, have some self-observation. Then after that, have some consultation with others, with our spiritual guides or our well-wishers. And then there is experience. Okay, we do things and see how it works out. So I would say Swadharma is something which some part of it is just our situation determines it and we can't do much out of it. And some part of it is where we can introspect and we can learn and we can choose. Does it address your question?
Prabhu, how do you distinguish it from dharma?
No,
are
the
they
same
correlated?
Thing. The same thing. The dharma for an individual is the Swadharma. There can be a dharma for society. There can be a dharma of a community. There can be a dharma of a person according to a particular position. So Swadharma refers to our duty according to our particular situation. So for Arjuna, who is a Kshatriya, to be forgiving and to take up the duty of a Brahmana, that is Paradharma. So, but for Arjuna to be a Kshatriya was a Swadharma. So whatever is the dharma according to our swabhava, that is our swadharma. So dharma can be, dharma at so many levels. So the dharma of a particular individual is called their swadharma. Does it address your question?
Prabhu, but in our life, swadharma keeps changing because of the varnashram.
Yeah, fine. So life is dynamic. So, you know, say somebody's a student, their role, their duties are different. When they get married, their duties become different. When they become parents, they become grandparents, their duties will become different. So that's like Varnashram also. We have the duties of a brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprastha, sannyasi are different at different stages in life. So,
but
you know, Yeah, go ahead.
We always associate dharma with spirituality. Don't we?
No, there are two different things over here. There is aparadharma and there is paradharma. So there is paradharma is what is of the soul's relationship with Krishna. And aparadharma, our existence is bidimensional. You know, we have the soul and we have a particular body. So our body determines our psychophysical nature. And according to our psychophysical nature, we have different things that we are good at. Okay, I understand where you're coming from now. You are using the word dharma in the sense that Prabhupada says dharma is the innate quality. Dharma, like water's dharma is liquidity, like, or fire's dharma is to burn. So you are associating dharma in that sense. The soul's dharma is to love and serve. So the soul's sanatan dharma is to love and serve the supreme sanatan reality, Krishna. That is true, no doubt about it. At the same time, the soul is in a particular situation at each phase in life. So, okay, our ultimate dharma is to love and serve. But to love and serve whom, in what way? That will vary from person to person, from situation to situation also. So, dharma, is it associated with spirituality? Yes, ultimately, the paradharma is directly our devotional activities. Say we chant the holy names, we study scriptures, we do puja. All this is our paradharma. And then our aparadharma is our family duties, social duties, professional duties. And for a devotee, ultimately the para and the apara both are meant for the pleasure of Krishna. The paradharma, direct devotional activities are what? So basically the soul's nature is to love and serve. There are some activities where we love and serve Krishna directly. We worship his deities, we chant the holy names. And there are some activities where we love and serve Krishna indirectly. That means we take care of our family, we take care of our job. But that is also a devotee wants to do that in a mood of service. So if we are doing that with the seva bhav, swakarmana tam abhyarcha siddhim vindati manava. Swakarma, that through your work, worship the Lord, the Bhagavad Gita states. So in that sense, there is one dharma that is to love and serve. The ultimate dharma is to love and serve the Lord. But the way it is expressed will vary according to situation. Does it address your question?
Yes, Prabhu. But we always associate dharma with yajnas and puja and those things. But you are talking of the practical thing. Which of the two should one follow?
No, both are there. I mean, can you stop doing your practical activities? And are we to see the practical activities as adharmic? No, they are not adharmic. The category of para and aparadharma is very much there in the Bhagavad Gita. Now I have a separate class on and what are the occasions when Krishna uses the word dharma in the Bhagavad Gita, and what is the meaning of the word dharma in that context? So Krishna says dharma samsthapanarthaya sambhavami yuge yuge. So then if dharma is our innate nature, why does Krishna have to come to establish dharma? So that when he says the word dharma samsthapanarthaya, that means that he is coming to establish the socio-political order that will be conducive for dharma. So Krishna is not, when he's talking about dharma, he's not talking about establishing bhakti over there. You know, when Yudhishthira Maharaj was the king, in his kingdom, there were Shaivites, there were Shaktas, there were other kinds of worshippers also. Yudhishthira Maharaj didn't outlaw all of them and said, all of you have to chant Hare Krishna and practice bhakti. Now, bhakti is the highest dharma. It is a matter of the heart. When Krishna says he is coming to establish dharma, he is basically, in today's terminology, we can say he is coming to establish law and order in society. Duryodhana was a vicious person. So that is one meaning of the word dharma. So dharma is law and order in society. Then you consider another instance where sarva dharman parityaja mam ekam sharanam vraja. So if dharma refers to our innate nature, then why is Krishna telling give up dharma? So there Krishna is talking about dharma in a different sense. Krishna is saying dharma can refer to socio-political order in society, law and order in society. When Krishna is saying Arjuna, give up sarva dharman parityaja, what he means is he refers to dharma as duty over there. Arjuna has a kshatriya duty to fight against aggressors. Arjuna has a kula dharma duty, kula dharma that he has to protect the members of his family. So which dharma does he follow? So Krishna says, don't get into all this confusion. Just forget about your various duties. Know that your topmost duty is to serve me. Mam ekam sharanam braja. And then adopt that dharma which will enable you to serve me. So the word dharma has many different meanings, and we can't reduce it to one meaning alone. So what is our swadharma? Well, bhakti is our swadharma, definitely. But according to our swabhava, according to our social situation also, there is swadharma. So both have to be done properly. So we often equate dharma with bhakti, but the Bhagavad Gita doesn't equate dharma with bhakti. Bhakti is the paradharma. In the Bhagavatam, there's a famous verse, Vasudeva para veda, Vasudeva para makha. So Vasudeva paro dharma. So dharma is the supreme level of bhakti. Even in Satyuga, even in previous ages where people were much more pure, that doesn't necessarily mean everybody was going to be a bhakta at that time. Everybody was dharmic. Everybody lived a life of virtue, followed certain codes of dharma. But that doesn't mean everybody was a devotee. The devotion is a matter of the heart. And matters of the heart can't be forced. So you can't legislate that everybody has to worship Krishna alone. There is one of the inclusiveness and diversity is one of the features of the Vedic tradition. So the idea is dharma is, okay, I'll conclude with this. Dharma essentially means to live in harmony with who we are presently, so that we can become who we are meant to be ultimately. I repeat this. Dharma means to live in harmony with who we are presently. Say, if I presently have a certain capacity for austerity, certain capacity for yajna, dana, tapa, as you said, talking about, if I try to do more than that, it will be unbalanced. You know, if I can fast by taking maybe one meal per day, or one meal on Ekadashi, and if I try to do nirjal, my body may collapse. So my dharma is at a present level, some activity I do at a certain level, so that ultimately I can come to the level of paradharma, that is pure love for Krishna. So we could say, this is becoming more complicated, maybe we can have a separate class on this topic, but let me explain this once in a simple way. The word dharma has many different meanings. So we are at a particular level of consciousness right now in this world. And the soul in pure consciousness loves Krishna. Okay. So now for us, dharma has three different aspects. One is, while we are living here, we need to live harmoniously. We have a particular kind of body and mind. We need to live harmoniously with our body and mind as it is right now. That's one level of dharma. Then second is, but we don't really want to stay over here right now. Say, if we are in a family, if we're in a job, we can't just be responsible at our job or our family. That will disrupt our life. So we have to live. Dharma also refers to that. The second is, but we don't just want to stay here. From here, we want to rise up to pure spiritual consciousness. So dharma also refers to the processes by which from here we will rise up to higher level. And these are our direct devotional activities. And as we keep doing the direct devotional activities, they will become more and more natural. They will become more and more spontaneous. And when we are liberated from the world, then we come to the level of just pure devotional activities. So that is the eternal nature of the soul. So right now, dharma, when Krishna says that I have come to establish dharma, that means at this level when people are living, how can they live in a way that is harmonious? Now, if society is completely disorderly, then it's very difficult for people to do anything at all. So Krishna says, I am coming to establish dharma means I am coming to establish order in this world so that people can practice the processes by which they can rise beyond this world. So 4, 7 and 8 in the Gita are about establishing order in this world. Dharma samsthapanarthaya sambhavami yugege. And 4, 9 is about rising out of this world. Janma karma cha me divyam evam yoviti tatvata tyaktva deham puna janma naiti mam iti so Arjuna. So when we talk about dharma, yes, you were talking about the activities which will help us rise from here to here. Yes, that is paradharma. And I was talking about activities that help us function harmoniously where we are. That is aparadharma. So dharma includes both aparadharma and paradharma. Okay.
Thank you, Prabhu. Thank you very much. Sorry to have taken so long.
No, it was an important question. And I'm happy that we were able to clarify to some extent. Thank you very much.
Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna.
Prabhupada ki jai. Bhishma Pitamaha ki jai. Bhishma Panchayat ki
Prabhuji,
jai.
do you have time? One more Prabhu wants to ask question.
Oh, okay. One last question then. Sure.
Okay.
Hare Krishna, Prabhuji. Hare
Krishna, Sureshwar Sam Prabhu. Good to see you.
Good seeing you, Prabhuji. Prabhuji, one question, Prabhu. In Bhagavad Gita, we see in the second chapter, Prabhupada, and you also mentioned briefly in your talk.
Sureshwar Sam, she said, was her son.
We also briefly mentioned, Prabhu, in your talk that Bhishma and Drona are obliged to take the side of Duryodhana because of his financial assistance, although they should not have accepted such a position simply on financial considerations. So, yeah, you know, sometimes this topic, this is very difficult to understand, Prabhuji, like Bhishma Dev, you know, being finally financial obligated and supporting Duryodhana.
Okay. No, so as I said, that there are multiple levels of explanation. Now we have one of the problems, it's called Niyamagraha in Bhakti. Niyamagraha means to stick to the letter of the law while forgetting the purpose or the spirit of the law. So if we want to look at it from a critical perspective, we can say that Bhishma succumbed to Niyamagraha over there. He stuck to his vow, but he forgot ultimately what is the purpose of the vow. So that's looking at it from a purely ethical perspective. But from a transcendental perspective, we understand that the Lord had a plan and Bhishma had to play a difficult role in that plan. So Bhishma knew that people would misunderstand him, but he took that role. What was that role? That no, somebody might be very powerful, very virtuous, but if they go against the Lord, then they will be destroyed. So the Lord wanted to teach that lesson and Bhishma became an instrument for teaching that lesson. So it was a very difficult service that Bhishma took up. So, you know, these are extraordinary things. We don't choose like that, but we have to choose intelligently if we face difficult situations. At the same time, we don't judge casually or dismissively the great characters. And we try to learn what lesson is to be learned from them for our edification. Like in the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada says how Arjuna is so thoughtful that even in a war, he's not rushing impulsively. He's thinking about the consequences of action. And he's eminently qualified to learn the Bhagavad Gita because he's so thoughtful. But in the next chapter, second chapter, immediately Prabhupada starts saying that, hey, he's so attached, he's crying. Tears are a sign of ignorance and material attachment and everybody's suffering from the skin disease. Hey, what happened? Prabhupada's treatment of Arjuna in the first and second chapter of the Gita purport seems to be radically different. So what happens is, Madhusudan Saraswati in his commentary on the Bhagavad Gita explains that the first chapter's primary purpose is to show how Arjuna is qualified for enlightenment, is qualified for learning the Gita. And that's, so Prabhupada's purports are in that theme. And the second chapter, the point is, yes, he may be qualified for enlightenment, but he's not enlightened. He's ignorant. Right now he's ignorant. And that's the stress over there. So we have to see, sometimes the same pastime and the same personalities, they can be explained from different perspectives. So we have to see the perspective that is the most nourishing for us in our devotion. And that is also maintains our respect for the characters involved. So that's why I said, we don't judge Bhishma, but we learn what is relevant for us to learn from such pastimes. Okay.
Thank you very much, Prabhu, for very nicely, in a simple way, explaining this complex. Dismadev's pastime is a little complex for us to understand, but thank you. Explaining in few different
ways. Thank you very much. Wonderful to be with you all of you after a long time. Thank you. Hare Krishna. Shri Prabhupada ki jai.
Thank you very much, Prabhuji.
Yes,
you're very enlightening class. We are very grateful to you, Prabhuji, and we look forward for your association again, Prabhuji, in future. We can pay our obeisances to Prabhuji. Vancha kalpata rupyasya kripa sindhu prabhuja patita nam pavane Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Bhishma Devaki ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, His Grace Chaitanya Charan Prabhuji ki jai.
Thank you, Prabhuji. Hare Krishna.
Thank you.
Hare Krishna Prabhu. Thank you very much, Prabhuji. Hare Krishna.